When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello, Paul here. Before we start with Season 3 of History Rage, I'd just like to shout out a big thank you to our three new Patreon subscribers that joined us in June. Those are Stephen Merriman, Tad DePell, and Laura Hardy. Thank you. Because your contribution helps keep this rage going, and I want you to know it's appreciated. Thank you. Hello, and welcome to History Rage, the podcast all about giving members of the historical community a safe space to rip apart history and get angry with the shreds. I'm public historian Paul Bavel, and I'm here with my ever-loyal co-host, good friend, and fellow historian, Kyle Glover.
Hello.
And we're back. We're back with Series 3. Who'd have thought that?
I know. Three seasons, which means we've got one more season than the young ones. And wow. I don't want to terrify you and our other listener, but season two of The Young Ones finished 5 years before I was born.
That's depressing.
Yeah, I know. But anyway.
But we digress. Yes. Well, dear listener, thank you very much for coming back to us. And we are kicking off this week with a rage that's very close to my heart and one that's been on our target list since we started History Rage. Now, this is a rage that produced some strong language and some strong emotion. And when we've gone back to it over the editing, we've decided to stick with this. So listener discretion is advised. Strong language will follow. Ladies and gentlemen, to kick this series off, we're welcoming historian, author, broadcaster, co-founder of the podcast History Hack, Alex Churchill, and historian and tutor, Andy Locke. And together, they are just two of the trustees of the Great War Group charity. Guys, welcome to History Rage.
Hello.
Hello.
Now, Andy, we've connected on Twitter and I followed your epic marathon in World War One kit. And seriously, well done. Well done for that. That looked hard.
And, yes.
And Alex, I've pretty much learned everything I know about war factories from you and the Yesterday Channel.
Excellent.
But for our other listener, please tell us a bit about yourselves and the project that is the Great War Group.
Can I just say, though, that my overriding memory of Lockie's marathon run was when he came over the finishing line live on BBC and went for his watch and he kind of staggered and I thought he was going to hurl all up the advertising boardings live on BBC. And I was like, do it, do it, do it.
I was about to hurl my Apple Watch into Lockhouse Garden.
I just feel like it would have been a crowning glory if you'd have puked all over the Santander boarding, but you didn't.
No, I'd have doubled my donation for that.
what I did, I mean, after I'd sort of had an argument with my watch and worked out that it wasn't going to play ball, I was then fumbling for one of the hip flasks in one of my pouches. One of the bonuses of having loads of pouches across your chest with First World War soldiers' kit is you can put stuff in. It's mostly Haribo, to be fair.
I was
going to
say, but isn't it mostly hairy gummy bears?
Haribo?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, mostly Haribo. I had a little tub of Vaseline. in one of them as well. That was liberally applied to the nipples as I went, and there was a little hip flask that was almost exactly the same size and shape as a German egg grenade from the First World War. It was really awkward when that dropped out just as I was setting off.
Brilliant if you've been rugby tackled on the floor by like SO15 or whatever.
No, the steward didn't bat an eyelid. He's like, oh, you dropped your grenade, mate. I'm like, oh, yeah, thank you. Picked it up and off I go.
Yeah, awesome. I watched you run that marathon on telly. It was great.
So tell us, as we asked, a bit about the Great War Group charity and what it's about.
So we founded it, didn't we, Lockie, the six of us, to give people a fun space to get involved in the First World War and sort of, I think we kind of dovetail quite nicely with the independent company. If you're keeping tracks with that and James Holland and Al Murray and that, it's kind of a similar thing in that it's a group of people that kind of want to enjoy their interest in military history whilst doing the reverence thing as well. And it's inclusive, and we're not definitely at the Great War Group. I mean, within like 5 minutes, we had gay members, straight members, trans members, all different ethnicities and stuff. And we definitely wanted it to be like anyone with an interest in military history could rock up and get involved.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of different people, but all with quite a similar mindset. Everyone's keen to share. There's people who are, you know, qualified to the umpteenth degree, and also people who are brand new to it as well. And everyone's sharing the knowledge as well. And also just the love for that piece of history. And I think doing it right well.
I was going to say, our mantra, isn't it, is there's no such thing as a stupid question. If you're just at the beginning and you're asking a question, that you don't need to be mocked for it.
No.
And that is a welcome sentiment. That really is. Well, if I can start off then by asking that obvious stupid question that starts, and the one really that History Rage is all about. So, Alex, Andy, in your own time, with as much emotion as you feel it musters, can you please tell our listeners the one thing that you really wish people would just stop believing?
Ugh, lions led by donkeys can just fuck off.
It is the laziest, most boring trope about the war, and also just doesn't get it at all. You've got to how your starting point from the winners were somehow incredibly stupid and just callously sent men off to die. Oh, come on. No.
But also as well, the idea that you would have, in your chosen profession, got to director level as a complete moron who didn't know what they were doing and survived 5 years in the nastiest environment for your profession going, ever seen, in fact, in the history of the world, and not been fired somewhere along the way and still be rubbish at your job as well.
Wow.
Yeah. When you put it like that, yeah.
Yeah. It's absolutely blindingly obvious. I would say one of the big things, big themes behind the First World War, the Great War for me, if there was two things in school I really didn't like, it was history and bloody poetry. And the First World War just combines the two. You know, what is this poetry bollocks, and is it anywhere close to actually, you know, the truth?
No, this can do one as well, can't it, Lockie? This is a few bored, flowery guys sitting there. I mean, and to be fair to them, they're writing down their experience and it's their way of projecting their experience, and that's fair enough in that. But how we went from a few of them writing miserable poems about the war to this apparently encompassing how everyone in the war felt about the war and articulated it. And the only thing worth studying, if you're a school kid, blows my fucking mind. It really does.
Well, it's disingenuous as well, because Siegfried Sassoon's a psychopath on the song.
He's the worst for me as well. I look at his face and I do that Clint Eastwood thing from Gran Torino, like, nah.
You don't get a military cross, but I mean, he practically scuppered his battalion by wanting to drag men off and kill Germans off on his own, or take a handful with him. No, he's a lunatic. So writing this wistful, wordy nonsense about how terrible it all is, he's a willing participant in some of the worst
bits. Respect, don't know about you, Lockie, for people like Rupert Brooke and Kipling, who got paid to do the patriotic nonsense at the beginning, and at least doing a job, than Sassoon sitting there criticising higher command and moaning, as you rightly point out, when he's a psycho.
Yeah, and also kind of our misrepresentation of it, because The Canadian fellow McRae, his poem In Flanders Fields, that's often billed as some wistful thing. It's not. It's talking about the worst thing to do would be give up on this war. You think about what the last part of that poem is. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you, from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If you break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep. It's not, oh, this is a terrible war. Let's pack it in. It's the opposite of that. It's carry on. Smash your enemies. All right? So I actually like McRae a bit more. I don't like how it's
portrayed. Because he's honest.
Yeah.
Even if we find it nonsensical now. Do you know what? For me, it's like, it epitomises all this historical nonsense at the moment where we just view everything from a completely warped, woke 21st century lens, as if that's how they thought as well. And it's not.
Yeah. So, you know, how did they think at the time of the war? Were they, you know, you see all the things of like them lining up. It's going to be all over by Christmas. We're going off for an adventure. You know, what was the mindset of the common Tommy, the guy that would have ended up in the trenches?
Do you know what? Peter Hart sums it up best, doesn't he, Lockie? When he says things like, your average Tommy isn't sitting there wistfully thinking about take up arms and fight the foe and all of that bollocks. He's thinking, oh, I could really do with a nice big ship with some decent toilet paper for once. I mean, we romanticise the living daylights out of this experience. Yeah. And actually, I mean, one of the best accounts I've ever seen of the war is a South African serving with the Coldstream Guard. And they're like, so what did you do in the trenches all day? What? When I sat there for 23 and a half hours a day with nothing to do, I was a 19-year-old boy and the only thing I had to play with was my cock. I wanked myself silly in the trenches. We all did.
I didn't see that coming.
Good Lord.
It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. But it's brilliant. When you think about it, 500 men, it's sitting in a hole with nothing to amuse themselves apart from their own genitalia. Of course, you're men.
Teenage men at that.
Exactly. Yeah,
of course. That's what of course they're going to.
This is all tough to deny.
I don't want to die a virgin is probably quite a big one going through the heads of these teenage boys. Not, oh, how can I publish some nice war poetry that condemns society's sending me to this place? No.
So the war poetry is the, you know, the guys that aren't going to get laid.
Yeah, basically.
I bet they did.
By each other. No, there's a good bit of prevalence there, isn't there? Yeah. Which is all fair and well. There was a hell of a lot of that going on in the trenches as well.
Well, VD rates. We need to have a discussion on VD rates.
Yes, we do. Lost man hours owing to STDs in the First World War was nearly the subject of my master's. And then I thought, do you know what? I can't spend 2 years obsessing over penile discharge. I'm going to do self-inflicted wounds instead.
And writing 12,000 words on that is...
Oh, no, 30,000 for a month.
30,000 words.
Yeah. So I just, I think... Someone needs to do a proper PhD in sex in the First World War, I think. But yeah.
Somewhere somebody's going to do that and somewhere somebody will fund it.
Yeah.
So just to sort of kind of set the scene of the Great War for particularly just for the non-modern historians in our audience and myself included. In the space of about 5 minutes, can you give us a kind of layman's guide to how we go from an angry Serb shooting a posh Austrian to Britain, France and Germany facing each other across Belgium?
We didn't, because you've missed out 3,000 steps before that, about 200 blokes in the middle interfering. And the fact is that by the time the first shot was fired on like the 27th, 28th of July across the Danube, no one gave a shit about Franz Ferdinand. The irony is, he's the one person that might have stopped it. But he's the one person who's for the last 10 years or whatever before that gone, oi, no, at bloody Conrad and his chums every time they've tried to take Austria to war, which is the irony between it. I mean, it was going to break out no matter what happened. The climate was there politically. Everyone knew there was going to be a war. And this just happened to be the straw that broke the camel's back. That's essentially what happened. So, they shot him and Austria didn't give a crap that they shot him. But they were like, oh, well, this is an excuse to sort Serbia out because we don't really like Serbia. They're uppity. They're independent now. There's loads of Serbs who are quite mouthy living in our own empire. And we can lay down a marker here and sort them out. So they send this ridiculous ultimatum to Serbia. They've already forgotten Franz Ferdinand. Even the emperor, his uncle, looks bored at his funeral. No one cares that they died. No one respects their dead bodies. No one respects their funeral service. In fact, there's a courtier that hates them so much that he literally tries to make sure that there's something else for everybody to do that day so they don't have to go to the funeral. No one cares. This ultimatum goes to Serbia, and it basically, what was it? Is it Churchill or Asquith that says it will basically reduces Serbia to the level of like a county council or whatever. It was a shocking...
I think grey, but yeah, someone like that.
One sovereign nation to send to another saying, we demand to send blokes into your country with complete jurisdiction to start dishing out justice. And Serbia, actually, with the exception of one clause, go, all right, just give it to them, give them what they want. Serbia and Austria aren't interested because 2 weeks before that ultimatum, Alexander Hoyos has already caught a train to Berlin and convinced Germany to enter this madness with them. And so then Germany follow Austria and then Russia. This is brilliant as well. Russia, defender of the Slavs. I've just finished translating a brilliant treatise out of French of a Polish Duma representative in Russian Poland, who basically says, defender of Slavs, let me give you a list of all the obscene things they do to Polish Slavs within their own empire. So Russia are full of it as well when they decide they're going to go and defend Serbia, but they're not going to let Germany pick a fight without getting involved. And then France are buggered because France are on the other side and they're allied with Russia. And then besides, Germany decide they're going to take out France anyway, and but in doing so, trample all through Belgium and Luxembourg. Britain's kind of dithering on the outside going, well, we don't really legally, if you look at the document, we don't have to do anything for Belgium. But then they're rubbing our hands with glee and going, yeah, but if there's a war and we win, we'll get stuff at the end of it.
Yeah.
And there you have it, a European and instant worldwide war, because they've all got empires. And I love, there's a brilliant bit where they're all like, no, right? We're just agreeing not to touch each other's colonies. And with about half an hour, someone's marched into a German colony in Africa, and people, the first British shots of the First World War are fired in Africa. That's how much they listen to that plan. So do you see how I've not mentioned Franz Ferdinand or the idiot that shot him at all for 5 minutes now? Because they're not even relevant. And that little tubercular weakling that fired the shot, who just happened to be standing in the right place at the right time after they completely buggered up their own attempts to kill the guy, really has got it. They're a catalyst, and they're the one that we remember because they're the catalyst that sent the world to war. But Lockie, it had nothing to do with them at all, did it?
Absolutely not. You know, what's dominating the headlines in England at this time?
Ireland
is. So you've got trouble with the Irish and the business over home rule. You've got 200,000 armed men in Ireland ready to go to war over that.
Asquith loves the First World War. This saves his career because he's backed himself into a ridiculous Irish corner over Tyrone and whatever other county it was, where he's literally going to end up losing his job because he's messed it up so badly. And then war comes along and everyone forgets what a dick he's been.
If I can just kind of duck in it, because this is actually a thing I've been researching as well. But yeah, I'm absolutely with you there. For Asquith, this is probably the greatest thing that happened, because it manages to take Ireland kind of off the table while there's something else going on. Also, gets the suffragettes to shut up.
Yep. And let's
not win-win.
The French aren't even bothered. The French are all obsessing over this nutty woman who was she the wife of was it the lover or whatever? It could only happen in France, but some woman,
it's a massive affair scandal, isn't there?
Yeah. And shoots a guy. She asked for a meeting with it's Madame Caillou, isn't it? Or Caillou.
That's it.
And the guy she kills, she walks into his office and goes, I need a meeting with him, and they're like, can you wait half an hour? And she's like, yes, okay. So she waits for half an hour, and then she goes into his office and pulls out like the smallest, weediest gun you can think of and shoots the guy, and then gets off. But the trial is happening that summer, so the French don't care either.
No. And actually, kind of, it starts slowly after the assassination, because the Austrians are just getting the harvest in. They know exactly what they're going to do anyway.
Yeah. Not... They need to buy 2 weeks for the French state visit to Russia to finish, because the worst thing that could happen is they try and kick all this off whilst the president of France is sitting around a dinner table with Tsar Nicholas II. So they go, like that, and twiddle their thumbs until he buggers off home again, and literally wait till he's in the middle of the sea to do it.
Well, that's got me royally told, because somebody once asked me once, like, can you name one historical person that changed the world? And I went, Gavrilo Princip, which wasn't the answer they were expecting. And now I find out that's completely wrong.
Yeah, I mean, he's just a tool. He's not quite as much of a tool as Kabrinovich, one of the other assassins, who literally, I love the way that he's trying to chug on a cyanide pill, but it doesn't work. So he tries to lob himself in the river, but people just get in there and start kicking lumps out of him and drag him off and stuff. And so he's going like, I die for my cause. And they're like, ah, shut up. And they're stamping on him, basically. So, but and then he gets dragged past Princip, who thinks, I should probably shoot him, so he shuts up, but doesn't do that right either. They are literally, it's like Laurel and Hardy do assassination.
Yeah, this is an assassination that could only have been put together by a government. It's that incompetent.
Yeah, and if I was the one that ended up dead because of such a shit assassination attempt, I'd come back and haunt everybody. I'd be pissed off. Because how you don't survive this nonsense. And it's the fact that literally, it's Petoriak, isn't it, Lockie, the governor of Bosnia. He could not have tried harder to get the guy assassinated. He spends no time on security. There's a whole army just outside Sarajevo doing maneuvers. Does he call one man in uniform into the city to protect the heir to the throne? Does he? Bollocks. No, he's horrible. He does not care. You've got Franz Ferdinand going, I don't feel well. Perhaps I shouldn't do this visit. And everyone's going, shut up and do as you're told. I just literally... The amount of nonsense that had to happen for that assassination to be successful is ridiculous.
The amount of reverence they attach to the car in the military museum in Vienna is quite funny. They've got this really naff-sounding alarm that goes off, which I set off when I visited, because there's a bullet hole in the side of the car, and I went, ooh.
Oh, you've got to touch it, right?
Poke my finger in the bullet hole. Yeah, and a little Austrian man comes running over when the alarm goes off and says, oi, don't do that.
And then sees your 7 foot tall and goes, yes, you want to, in which case it's fine.
Right, I know we're going to get hate mail for this one, as we do with all of our episodes recently, but I'm just going to come out with it. How much is Blackadder responsible for this? Because as soon as you said, how did the First World War start, in my head I started quoting that one episode of Blackadder. So how much is that to blame?
Archie Duke.
Yep. Lucky, you can take this one away. It epitomises something else, doesn't it? And it's not all Blackadder's fault, but Blackadder was jumping a bandwagon.
Yeah, it was. So the Blackadder Goes Forth came out in 1989, and that really is the kind of pinnacle of the gloomy kind of, we were so crap in the First World War period. And kind of funnily enough, the books that come along quite soon after that are like, oh, hang on a minute, maybe actually we should look at it a little bit differently, seeing as we did win and everything. Well, maybe we didn't do everything wrong all the time. But, I mean, Ben Elton's the writer, and if you read his other bit of First World War work, that sucks as well. The thing with Blackadder that I don't get is nobody looks at the second and third seasons, do they, and say, oh, wow, this is a really gritty and realistic portrayal of the Elizabethan court. Or, this nails the Regency period down to a T. Okay?
Yeah. No. Prince George was exactly like this.
Exactly. And I've got, a guy that I really like and respect at my rugby club comes up to me and says, oh, so Blackadder, it really was like that, wasn't it? No! Definitely
I'm surprised
not.
You're not still at that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, it's what it. I mean, here's the other kicker, though. I do like it. I think it's funny, but it's a sitcom. Yeah. It's not documentary. Okay, it's a sitcom set in a place, and that's all it is. Okay, it's silly, and it makes us chuckle. Okay, I mean, the portrayal of General Melchior, none of it makes sense. If you actually know anything about kind of army structure and what battalions actually did when they came into the line and how a kind of company works and how a battalion, how a brigade, how a division works, you do not have this scenario where you're just sat in a generic dugout for the next opportunity to chuck yourself over to death, essentially. Command doesn't kind of have that kind of function. If you see what I mean. General Melchior, I'm not quite sure what level of command he's supposed to have.
To me like a divisional commander, because he's, judging by how far back he's about, or even corps command, you might think.
Yeah, I'd have thought that, but you don't quite get it. He's got to have some.
Yeah. Flouncing... He had one fucking staff member for a start.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yes. Captain Darling, who flounces around and dodges.
That might be his private secretary, but where are the other 10 guys? The artillery general, the engineer, the adjutant general. Where's everybody else?
I think the single biggest thing is that it simplifies this war to a level that it just wasn't at. And I think, you know, the kind of overarching question that we had for this, what sets us off? Oh, it was the lions led by donkeys. If I could add another kind of element to this, is people think they understand the First World War. They think it's simple, all right? These cascade of alliances happened. Everyone got stuck into each other because they couldn't be bothered to do anything else. And then they just chucked. And they just chucked men at the situation for 4.5 years until Germany mysteriously surrendered or something like that. And it personified in a cracking sitcom in which we get rats run over by vans and then served as dinners to general staff. And we have Commander Flashart charging around at the head of the 20 minuters.
We apparently have an RFC training school within a core command structure as well on the Western Front, which is bollocks. Just for a start. No, the pilots didn't all go round to the general's chateau to train and train for half an hour and then get in an aeroplane.
Yeah.
I mean, the hospital episode I found especially funny, actually. But,
the one I love is the one with where George dresses in drag and does they do the show, because they actually did have people doing shows like that. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, yes, yes.
One thing I've noticed in watching that, and it's a little detail that I hope I'm interpreting correctly, otherwise, you know, I'm totally cutting this bit out. if you actually look at Captain Darling, you know, for all his fear and his cowardice, am I seeing this correctly? Because as far as I can see, he's wearing a military cross.
I've never looked at his medal ribbons.
No, I've
never. Have a look at that.
To be honest, though, the Prince of Wales got given a military cross. As well. Even he was embarrassed by it, because he was like, I have not. I almost accidentally got shelled when I was sitting in my car and we killed a French bloke, or a French bloke lost his leg because we ran him over. I mean, unless that's why they gave him the military cross, because they managed to sever the limb of a French farmer whilst running around in a Rolls Royce Silver Ghost or whatever it was.
I'm just looking at that. For me, it changed the view of Captain Darling. But moving on to the side there.
Yeah, pretty sure that's a purple and white ribbon that he's got there.
Yeah. And that's that, you know, not cowardice, potentially PTSD, never mentioned.
Do you know how they chose a purple and white ribbon, though? It's brilliant. So there was this epic meeting with, and Kitchener was getting really, really pissed off because people just kept faffing with the design of this medal and what it was going to look like. And you've got, representing the king, you've got Fritz Ponsonby, who's an army officer, and he's basically in charge of the king's finances. And they send Fritz along because Fritz loves a good row. And they're sitting there and Fritz is like, all right, we've got all these designs, but this one overachieving wanker turns up with a gilded design for a medal, which is all coloured in and everything. And Ponsonby says, I knew as soon as I saw it that Kitchener had picked that one, because he's like a fucking magpie. And he did. That's the design he picked. But then they started like a 2-hour debate about what colour to have the ribbons. And Fritz had taken with him a Bible like this of medal ribbons for different countries, and every suggestion Kitchener came up with, he'd be like, oh, red and blue, no, I think you'll find that's the blah 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 cross from Thailand. Oh no, the black and white, well, that's the Paul and Marie, and we don't really want that. So after 3 hours of running around in circles, he goes, what about this lovely little purple and white number that my wife put together last night? And Kitchener goes, fine, we'll have that one. This could be over. So he basically, that medal ribbon is totally manipulated out of Kitchener by one of the king's private secretaries, because he wants his wife's design.
Awesome.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
So we've kind of touched on this before in one of the earlier questions, but it's pretty ludicrous to think we just spent 4 years throwing men into enemy machine guns and just waiting for something to change. How did tactics actually develop during the time of the Great War?
Loads is the honest answer, because there's elements of truth to the kind of popular idea on how kind of tactics went, because you know, you had an officer class who would carry a stick, you know, early on in the war in particular, and they would lead out a platoon that went forward. In 1914, everyone's really well trained, really. This is the original BEF goes out, and you've got a lot of professional soldiers out there, and it's fine. In 1915, you've got the kind of analogy that I use with school kids when I'm trying to explain this is essentially you've got like a flyweight boxer who pound for pound could potentially be the best in the world. But if you stick him in the ring with a heavyweight, he's going to get crushed. Okay, and that's kind of what the British Army was like at the start of the war. It needs to get bigger. So what happens is this flyweight boxer eats pies for some months until it reaches the sort of weight needed to get in the ring. Does that make him a heavyweight boxer? Absolutely not. And the performance isn't great. So you do have some officers still with sticks trying to lead guys forward, and it doesn't work all that well. Okay. Now, the big kind of catalyst for change is the Battle of the Somme. Already a lot has been learned by this stage. You got officers who don't carry sticks because they realize, funnily enough, if you carry a stick, you look pretty obvious as an officer and you're most likely to get shot first. So the officers by this stage know to carry rifles and dress a bit like the men. Okay. But yeah, the Battle of the Somme, especially the opening day, doesn't go well enough, certainly. You have a huge number of losses, and it's unrepeatable. You can't lose 57,000 men as casualties in a day and do that habitually. Okay, so things start changing immediately. Rather than big, ponderous shelling barrages where you shoot at the Germans for a week and try and bust everything up. Here's the thing. The Germans would have had to have been born yesterday not to know that an attack was coming. I've seen some work done that says, oh, there's intelligence failures and the Germans intercepted some messages that gave them a tip-off that the attack was coming. No, they saw 420,000 men move into the line in front of them. That's like the population of modern Cardiff, pretty much. And then we moved train loads of guns and ammunition into the area. If they couldn't have noticed this, then there would have a problem. Then we shot at them for a week.
That does give the game away somewhat, doesn't it?
Yeah, and then just before, as it were, 10 minutes before, in one case, we exploded these flipping great mines underneath sections of their line as well. All right, so the Germans have just been waiting for the exact signal of when exactly is this big attack going to come? Boom, 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 boom. Oh, how about now?
Yeah, all right.
So, things had to become a bit more sophisticated than that, and they did. All right, so 2 weeks later, they've done away with the week-long bombardment altogether. They concentrate on a smaller front, and they go for a five-minute hurricane barrage and then an immediate assault with the infantry after that. And that worked quite a lot better. Trouble is, the Germans learn as well. So they start concentrating their artillery. And so the next couple of months really is just banging away, quite small frontage, and it's attack, counterattack, 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 counterattack. It's, the old phrase is there's two things in life you can be sure of, death and taxes. There's actually a third thing, which is German counterattack. They will come for you at some point. So these counterattacks and counterattacks develop through July, August, and into September on the Somme. But all the time, people are thinking of solutions to the problems. And one big problem is barbed wire. What can you do with barbed wire?
Well, tanks become a solution. They get introduced in mid-September on the Somme with the battle 2.5 months old. We get these big bulletproof-ish metal boxes. They're not foolproof by that time, but they're a sign of things to come, certainly. Yeah. And so more and more of these come into the battlefield. By the early part of next year, we've moved on from a platoon being 50 riflemen led by an officer who says, come on, fellas, follow me, to 4 sections, each with their own weapon groups. You've got a light machine gun section, a rifle grenade section, a bayonet section, and a bomb section. And when it meets a German machine gun, it doesn't say, right, come on, let's charge it. It's, right, Lewis gunner and rifle grenadiers, put some fire on it, shut it up, bayonet and bombers, off you go and kill or capture the crew. All right, that starts to become something like modern soldiering. By the end of 1917, artillery progress has caught up as well. So they can fire bombardments without pre-registering. And pre-registering was always the thing that gave the game away as well, because you'd need to kind of have a few shots to range your guns up and stuff. And, you know, the German sees a shell drop to his left and another shell drop to his right and then one behind him and then one in front of him and thinks, I know what's going on here. I'm going to move. All right. Or I'm going to get my reserves in place. By the end of 1917, they don't get the warnings anymore. Accurate bombardments get fired. And also, you don't need to fire big destructive barrages to break up the barbed wire because you've got hundreds of tanks to do it by that stage. So by end of 1917, the battlefield looks so different to even kind of halfway through the previous year, never mind what it looked like in 1914. So there's so much that changes. By 1918, holding a single trench line is so dangerous because of the amount of artillery that can get concentrated onto a point without any warning that movement returns to the battlefield again. So that's when things really start breaking up. And, you know, if you kind of looking at things logically at the end of 1918, the Germans were in a position of real strength, and you'd sort of describe the situation, you think, how could the British and the French with the Americans possibly be on the winning side that year? But they did. And tactical progress is a real part of that.
So with each stage of this, you start off by sending some guys over the top in the traditional manner. You see what happens. We go, we can't do that again. Is it a case of trial, error, mostly error?
What's for both sides? I'll say that much. You know, the idea that only the Germans had the wit to think of things in a modern sort of sense and distribute lessons learned and stuff like that is nonsense. No, the British were sharing lessons around. Now, whether a divisional commander took that lesson on board, that's another...
There are some shit generals. There are.
There are now.
Yeah, there's still some, still plenty getting fired towards the end, weren't there? So, there were some crap ones, but on the whole, as the war went on, generals got younger, if that makes it, but also more experienced, because you'd have quite an old crop of generals coming in with maybe Boer War experience or something like that. Yeah. But by 1918, you've got divisional commanders who have maybe come up through the ranks from maybe kind of captain or major at the start of the war, had 4 hard years of war, seen the progress, seen the development, been with their men for a long time, and were young enough to still be kind of creative and sparky when it came to tactics as well.
Yeah, so you start off with these old guys that have, like you say, fought the Boer War or possibly even fought the Zulus, and... You know, by the end of the war, you've got people who spent 4 years fighting that war. That is the war that they know the most about.
Yeah, you've got divisional commanders in their 30s and 40s as opposed to in their 50s and 60s.
I mean, Smith Dory did fight the Zulus. He did.
Yeah, he did. He ran away from the Zulus quite effectively, in fact.
So talking of lessons learned then, you know, if you move to kind of the aftermath of the war, what do you think both sides learnt from that war going forward to their respective futures? I mean, we know where that future ends in 20 years' time, and we're kind of coming to that question a little later on. But in the aftermath of World War One, what lessons do you think were learned by each side?
Not enough, right?
Not enough. I think there's certain things with regard to how you close a war out, because I think one thing that they didn't quite understand at the end of the First World War is if you break it, you buy it. And they definitely broke Germany by the end of the war, but didn't want to take responsibility for putting down the German Revolution afterwards. So they sort of, oh, go on, you're going to have a go with a republic, are you? Fine, away you go with that. But it was almost doomed to fail from the start. Whereas at the end of the Second War, that didn't take place. You know, Germany was split up and very much put under new management, at least in those early years. So I think there's maybe one lesson in that. But apart from that, the kind of the immediate post-war years are bleak. You know, all the promises made to soldiers about a land fit for heroes, that sort of stuff. No, you got terrible unemployment and depressions, and it just doesn't work out for the soldiers. It could be quite a disheartening from a philosophical point of view as much as anything, but also just a putting food on the table point of view too.
Well, that's just Britain as well. I mean, we talk about the end of the war in 1918. If you think that everybody went back to holding hands and skipping around wearing daisy chains and stuff, bollocks. World burns for years afterwards. So about 1923, yeah. You've got revolutions, upheaval, localised conflicts going all over the place.
Right. And that's,
and
you know,
these all stemming from the end of that conflict.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you go, you look at a Greek war memorial and it says 1912 to 1921 or 1923 on it.
Turkey,
they
Ireland,
certainly do. Yeah.
Russia.
Yeah.
The idea that the war just ends and everybody goes, ah.
Germany.
Hungary are at it with Austria. No, Hungary are at it with who? They're definitely fighting someone.
Yes. Now, that's not an area that I've ever looked at. So you can give me an idea of kind of some examples of that instability in various places. I mean, you've got, you know, the end of the Ottoman Empire comes around that time, and there's clearly a power vacuum there. And no, of course, there's a 1919 revolution of Russia. What else is going on?
Well, the Russian Civil War goes into the 20s, and that's horrific. That's Russians fighting Russians. That's a terrible one. You've got Greece and Turkey going at each other, as they ever have done. You've got Ireland. You've got, well, name me some others, Lockie.
Berlin. You've got old British tanks with crosses painted on the side rumbling around in central Berlin. You've got machine guns mounted on the backs of cars, and you've got various Freikorps units. You've got naval Freikorps units fighting army Freikorps units as revolution grips in Berlin. So the idea that the fighting stops for Germany, no, it doesn't. It comes right home. And even after the revolution's put into some sort of order, you've got putsch after putsch and financial disaster and extreme politics coming along, and political murder very much the norm there. So all with everyone, I mean, they mobilized a huge proportion of their male population, much more than Britain did. And I've heard the years following the Great War described as the golden age of domestic violence. Okay, and that's as simple as the thing is, you know, everyone's come home with a massive case of PTSD and desensitization to violence, and you sat at home and your wife gives you grief because you haven't done the washing up or something like that, and smack because you don't appreciate what violence is to the same extent. Well, Germany had it much, much worse than Britain. Actually, kind of Britain and Germany do have some things in common, and the fighting in Ireland, I kind of liken the black and tans in Ireland to the Freikorps units in Germany. A lot of ex-soldiers who don't know how to act around civilians anymore.
I suppose that one of the things that gets often overlooked, and we've seen this with various kind of like weapon displays and things like that, is you have this thought of the First World War being, you're going to go over the trench and it's all guns and rifles. But actually, when you get into a trench on the other side, the weaponry you're using is medieval. I mean, it is maces. It is clubs with nails through them. That's got to leave a mark on a man.
You ever seen a French bayonet? There's a reason that the Germans are running away from them in 1914. Like a
massive, I've not seen one.
Knitting needle, yeah, essentially. Like twice, three times the thickness, but a giant needle.
And like a they square are, point, isn't it? They're horrible, yeah.
Trained to stab the living daylights out of you. And it's like Nikolai Eberholz has got this account by an Austrian or Russian in the Carpathians, I think it is, where literally the guy's talking about shoving a bayonet in someone's eye and the grinding noise it makes on the socket and stuff. Oof. So, yeah, it medieval.
Yeah, and that's good. You take that home with you, and, you know, your wife, your kids, your family are going to be on the receiving end of that. That's pretty much unavoidable.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Well, that got dark.
Yeah, didn't it?
Yeah, bloody hell.
Okay, Kyle, carrying on the lesson theme then.
Yeah, so...
dive in.
So to carry on this theme, how much of the aftermath of the First World War carries over and is to blame for the Second?
Well, you kind of got this fashion now of saying that the war never ended. And that actually...
Yeah, it's all one war.
It goes all the way through. It's all one war that goes all the way through. World War Two really is just the sequel, people. It doesn't happen without World War One. It doesn't happen in a vacuum.
Yeah.
Happens because of World War One.
I was going to say, yeah, in terms of creating the conditions where a Second World War could take place, yeah, the First World War is special in a number of ways. I mean, the amount of, never mind lives lost, which is a source of bitterness and resentment for nations all through Europe and the world. The amount of cash burned, war is flipping expensive. And the First World War cost a phenomenal amount.
$5 billion a day by 1917 for Britain.
Yeah, and a million was more then than it is now.
Mm.
But Germany managed to spend a little bit more than Britain. Yeah, it was the only country that did, and then got the bill for everything afterwards, and so could never economically recover. And extreme politics can breed in that sort of situation where you've got resentment at a defeat that you don't see as a defeat necessarily.
Yeah, and it's always painted with the Treaty of Versailles. That's not just a defeat of Germany, but it's an absolute hammer home.
Could have been worse, but Lloyd George wanted the Kaiser dragged through the streets of London. No, actually, really? He wanted him sailed up the River Thames, Henry VIII style, and then dragged through the streets of London and hung as a war criminal. And it's the king that basically says to him, "Over my dead and lifeless body, you loon." And it's actually Churchill at the end of all people that says, like, this needs to let everybody back away and calm down a bit because this is not going to help. And God bless the Netherlands for telling everybody to piss off when they were demanding that he be extradited.
Oh my God, Angus, you've just got to look at any situation where Churchill is your staying
voice
hand.
Of reason.
Yeah.
I think we all need to calm down, guys.
Yeah. Good. Deep breaths, everyone. Just back away and we'll... Good grief.
It wasn't a huge surprise that the Versailles terms were going to be harsh. I mean, just before the armistice was signed, the kind of terms of the armistice come through and a hint of what's to follow is given to the German delegation at Compiègne, where they sign this thing. And the fellow they sent off to sign it is a guy called Matthias Erzberger, who was a Catholic centre politician who'd led the calls for peace, actually, in Germany the previous year. And that's why they sent him as much as anything, because they knew he was serious. But he gets in touch with the kind of main men in Berlin, and really it's Friedrich Ebert by this stage, who goes on to be Germany's first president. He'd been calling for peace without annexations as well. He gets to hear the terms of the armistice and what's to follow, immediately goes to the army commanders and says, "Can you keep fighting? Because this is so harsh. I want us to fight for a few more weeks and maybe the Allies will come back with something a little less draconian."
Wow.
And the army commanders just say no. With Austria folding and we're about to have an Italian Franco-Anglo army march up through Bavaria and a Franco-Serbian-Greek army is about to march in through Dresden. So no. And we've got sailors. We've got German sailors who have attacked and occupied Kiel and Hamburg and Bremen. No, we cannot fight everywhere. So
it cannot be done.
That was it.
Thank you. Okay. Well, I'm gonna light the Alex touch paper now. So ever since the end of the Great War, then, in one form or another, we've commemorated Remembrance Sunday, and this goes like forward through time. I noticed one thing that you put out on social media earlier on, which is like late last year around the time, and I wanted to ask you this question, and do please don't catch fire. Has the remembrance industry gone too far?
Yes.
Just the fact you're calling it a remembrance industry.
Yeah. Industry is telling,
shit completely with the burger van on Horse Guards Parade last year. Because, come on, people. For a start, no, we haven't all hung our heads in... misery for the first God knows how many years. It was an epic excuse for ex-servicemen to meet up with each other, having survived the thing, and get totally shit-faced. It was party time. Those that survived got together, got utterly, utterly wankered in memory of all their friends and celebrated the armistice. Then they all started dying off and people were like, well, I didn't earn the right to do that. So perhaps I need to do it a little differently. So perhaps we need to be a bit more solemn. And then it turned into this virtue signalling wank fest, basically, whereby you can buy yourself a Lest We Forget thong online. A thong. What?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, whoever needs poppy-themed underwear.
Yeah, we don't. I have no problem with the British Legion expanding their shop and selling something other than a poppy. I thought the gin was too far. Or the rum, wasn't it? It was rum, it was. Pulled in on the rum. And they got that wrong, and whoever is in charge of their PR and stuff needed taken out the back and given a good kicking. But that is their symbol. And if you can raise money for guys, they supported my granddad when he put his back out in the aftermath of being in the army. And they put clothes on my mum's back. I've got no problem with them. But it is an industry now where everyone has commandeered the poppy and wants to make money out of it every November. And that makes me sad and angry.
It's cropping up all over the place as well, because it's not just the British Legion that's turning out now. I mean, I know the guys in my local British Legion, you know, whenever they're out collecting for the poppy appeal, they're always having that conversation with people of like, no, that isn't actually, you know, British Legion merchandise. That's coming from someone. No, I don't care if they give 5% of their funds to this. It's not part of us. And it's getting everywhere.
It doesn't collect money in November. That's their time. Like, literally, that is their time. They're once a year, and we're not bandwagoning that to try and get donations out of people. That's their gig. And we didn't do it in our first year, and we won't do it in our second year. Because stealing someone else's emblem to make money. And they own the copyright on that as well. So you were in breach of that when you slap a poppy on, I don't know, a dildo or whatever the fuck knows else you're going to try and sell. To try and raise yourself some cash, because these aren't charities doing it either. They're not.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, let's all make money out of remembrance. And it's infuriating. Yeah. But the sanctimony attached to some people's... I mean, I love it. And I know Lockie feels this too. I love people telling me how to do remembrance every November, because you're like, dude, every day of my life is remembrance. I literally study this 365 days a year. And along you wade on November the 11th and tell me how to do my thing. Do one.
Seriously.
Yep.
Yeah. And it is every day. But also, you know, the same people will chip in saying, oh, you take money from people to take them around the battlefields on tours or something like that. You're no better than any of these other guys. Well, no, hang on a minute. I actually do the research. You know, I actually tell the stories of these guys.
If they went away to the battlefield, wouldn't know what they were looking at. They want to know what they're looking at. They want someone to tell them and put it into context.
Exactly. And what does Lest We Forget mean if it doesn't mean remember it and learn about it and teach others about it? That's it.
Just buy something with it on it.
Yeah. I mean, who'd have thought, Lockie? We didn't need to bother going to university and being poor. We could have had real jobs and made money. And just bought a thong.
That would have sorted it. Yeah.
I'm not sure a thong's really for you, Lockie.
Oh, don't knock it till you tried it.
Okay. Well, you run the London Marathon in that next year then. Okay, guys, thank you very much. I think I think you'll all agree that's us good and told about ourselves.
Yeah,
and more importantly, good and told about the Great War. Thank you very, very much.
Welcome.
Thank you, guys.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to know more about the work being done, then you can check out the group's website at www.greatwar.com, and you can sign up to their range of talks, special events, tours. You can follow them on Twitter at Great War Group, and we'll put links to those in the show notes. You can also follow Alex at Churchill_Alex and Andy at Big Andy Locke if you need more history and more rage in your life. Once again, guys, thank you for what was truly an epic rage.
Yes, thank you very much. That was brilliant.
So, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. You can follow us on Twitter at History Rage, or individually, I am at Paul Babble.
I'm at Kyle G History.
And you can leave comments, thoughts, and please send your own history rages using the hashtag History Rage, because we want to know what really gets your goat. If you've enjoyed our work, then please subscribe, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It really means a lot to us when you do that. From all of us here at History Rage, thanks a lot for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.